DL, you know, I actually grew up in a place that looked a lot like this. My dad and I used to take our horses up to these incredible alpine lakes. We'd ride way back into some pretty wild, remote areas, with amazing streams, meadows, and tons of wildlife. I absolutely love it here, DL. Just look at this canyon. Totally reminds me of the Grand Canyon. You've got this little stream running through, and these super steep canyon walls rising up. How long do you think it would actually take for a stream that small to carve out this much material and cut a canyon this deep? This rock has a history just like I do and just like you do. Came from somewhere, you know? A lot of these rocks have been dated to be anywhere from 350,000 years old all the way up to a couple of million years. That's pretty ancient, DL. But it might surprise you to learn that all of the geological formations we're seeing here, the canyons, the layers, even the plants, are actually younger than I am. When I was born, there was absolutely nothing here but a huge, sprawling forest, hundreds of feet below where we're standing right now. In fact, before 1980, most people had never even heard of Mount St. Helens. Explosion rumbling. It was in that year, on May 18th, that molten rock created a massive steam blast, with the force of something like 20 million tons of TNT. Avalanche debris and other flows from the eruption laid down all of those layers incredibly quickly, up to 600 feet thick. A couple of years later, there was some more volcanic activity that caused a mud flow that carved out this entire canyon in just a couple of days. It also cut through deep bedrock, all in just a couple of days. Isn't it amazing what a little bit of information from the past can do to completely change how you see the present and the world around you? There are a lot of assumptions that a lot of people make about the history of the Earth around us. The real question is, how do those assumptions affect how we look at that history? But even more importantly, how do they influence how we see science and the Bible? Did God create the world in just a few days or over billions of years? Is mankind descended from apes? Or did God create us instantly in His own image? Was there a global flood that devastated the entire Earth? Or is that just a myth? In other words, is Genesis actually history? DL, when we start thinking about the history of the Earth, there are a whole lot of things we need to take into consideration. But one of the most fascinating is definitely the account of the flood. Was the whole entire Earth really covered with water? Genesis says that the waters rose so powerfully on the Earth that all of the high mountains under the whole heaven were completely covered. So, if the flood was truly global, wouldn't there be a ton of evidence to support that? I had heard about a scientist who had dedicated over 40 years to studying this very question. When I finally spoke to him, he told me he knew of a great place where we could see definitive evidence of this global flood. DL. Steve, I have to admit, I've actually been here several times before, but every single time I come, I'm just completely blown away. Steve, besides my own home, the Grand Canyon is definitely my favorite place on Earth. DL. So, Steve, tell me, what exactly are we seeing here? Steve, when we look at the Grand Canyon, we're really seeing the inside story of the ground beneath our feet. We've basically got a layer cake here, don't we, made up of different strata that have been eroded away, all for our viewing pleasure. So we can see the inner structure of the Earth. These exact same layers can also be found in Colorado, and also in Illinois and even in Pennsylvania. DEL. So, when you say sedimentary strata, you're referring to all the different layers that we can see? Steve, exactly. So, the lowest layers are formed first. These are sediment grains that were all mixed together, separated, and then flowed in here from different directions, and accumulated on top of each other. And then, of course, naturally, they turn into solid rock. DL. So, what you're saying is that the solid ground we're standing on right now, if we could go back in time and see its history, it would actually be liquid? Steve, yes, that's right. So, the ocean is doing some pretty amazing things, and water of incredible power is depositing all the layers we see in the canyon. DL. And are there fossils in all of those different layers? Steve. There are marine fossils scattered throughout all the layers, but the standard explanation is that there were 17 separate advances and retreats. of the ocean all across the North American continent, and that this all happened over hundreds of millions of years. DL, and what kind of evidence do you see here that would suggest that that explanation doesn't quite make sense? Steve, well, the 4,000 feet of flat-lying strata in the canyon are incredibly flat. And when we look at the relationships between the strata layers, we really don't see the passage of time in between the layers. DL. You mean erosion? Steve, exactly, erosion. Specifically, widespread erosion and channeling on any large scale just isn't visible. And then we look at the strata themselves, and they actually provide evidence of rapid, very rapid sedimentation. Just minutes or hours is all it would take to create these layers. DL. Well, tell me a little more about the story of these layers. I mean, how did they actually get here? Steve. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that very day all the springs of the great deep were broken up, and all the floodgates of the heavens were opened. My understanding is that there was a major upheaval of the ocean floor. Some kind of magma eruption or massive earthquake propelled the oceans right over the continent. DL. So, that would explain why we find all these marine fossils in these layers? Steve, exactly. And the waters prevailed upon the earth for 6 months. And then another 7 months or so for the water to recede. So, the 4,000 feet of strata probably represents the early and middle parts of the global flood right here in the Grand Canyon. We also have other strata locally in this Grand Canyon region. That's often referred to as the Grand Staircase. We've got about 10,000 feet, 2 miles worth of strata, sitting on top of the Grand Canyon. DL. Higher than where we're standing now. Steve, higher than where we are. And that represents the later stages of the flood and the retreat of the floodwater. This surface was beveled by the retreating floodwaters. And as the flood retreated into the newly formed ocean basins, then the continents likely uplifted. And the ark, of course, ended up landing in the high country of the Middle East. DL, well, there are some people who argue that that account is really about a local flood. Steve, I believe it was a global flood, and that all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. It's a universal statement. But we have to remember that mountains have risen since then. And we really shouldn't be trying to measure the depth of the floodwaters by the present-day mountains of the earth, which were largely created during and after the flood. DL. Well, the fact that we have all of these different layers would be completely unknown to us if we were just standing on them somewhere else, but we know about them because they've been cut out and exposed. How did that actually happen? Steve. Well, it's the story we all learned back in grade school, right? That the Colorado River, over tens of millions of years, slowly carved out the Grand Canyon. But most geologists have actually abandoned that idea. It's just really hard to imagine a canyon like this lasting for tens of millions of years. You just can't imagine a canyon enduring for that long with all the erosion that would occur. DL. Is that because eventually the sides would have collapsed and broken down? Steve, exactly. DL. So then, how in the world did we actually get this all carved out? Steve, well, there are a lot of different theories, but personally, I really like the idea of catastrophic erosion caused by the drainage of massive lakes. DL. So, after the flood, we had these large bodies of water, these lakes that were trapped. Steve, that's right. There's evidence of a huge lake in the Painted Desert, in a place called Hope Buttes, containing something like 500 cubic miles of water in this massive lake. DL. And so the dam breaks, and all of that enormous amount of water then pours out and carves this canyon out. Steve, yes. And how long would it take to erode the Grand Canyon that way? Maybe just weeks, but definitely not millions of years. Time isn't some kind of magic wand that solves all the geologic problems of the world. We need to ditch that way of thinking about millions of years and start thinking about catastrophic processes like what we saw at Mount St. Helens, and that will really help you understand the Grand Canyon. DL. Everywhere we looked, Steve showed me compelling evidence of the incredible power of moving water, how it quickly laid down these enormous layers, and then quickly eroded them away. Steve was really eager to show me where the floodwaters first hit the continent, so he took me even deeper into the canyon. DL. Steve, when you said you were going to bring me to the bottom, you really weren't kidding, were you? We're actually at the very bottom, aren't we? Steve, we're down in this big side canyon to the main Grand Canyon, and we're looking at the granite basement rock, which is basically the core of the continent, and then we see the flat-lying strata on top of it. The boundary between the granite rock below and the Tapeat sandstone above is this surface that we call the Great Unconformity. VL, why does it appear to be such a stark line? I mean, it's so clear and distinct. Steve, I believe it's an erosional boundary on a truly colossal scale. We're looking at something that really shows the sheer magnitude of the flood flow over a surface. DL. And is it just found here? Steve, the Great Unconformity is actually continent-wide. I've seen it, or at least I believe I've seen it, in the Middle East. It's found over in Europe. It's in Africa. And, of course, here it is under the North American continent. DL, so we've got this layer. How thick is this layer? What lies above it from here? Steve, well, we have the Sauk megasequence here, if you will, about 1,000 feet of sandstone, shale, and limestone that stretches right across the entire continent. And there are 4 other major sequence packages of strata that sit above it. Those are also very continuous, much like this one. What we're seeing here is actually pretty representative of what you'd find in the rest of the world. DL, it really makes you question the idea that this all happened because of some small local flood. We're talking about something absolutely enormous. Steve, the power of the moving water was leveling and pulverizing rock, depositing great thicknesses of layers, and really calling our minds to start thinking about a global flood. DL, the conventional story, though, is completely different. It would suggest that there was a massive amount of time between each of these layers. Steve, some people have even said that the Great Unconformity boundary here represents 500 million years. DL, you mean between the granite that we can see and that very first layer of sedimentary rock? Steve, yeah, that's right. They say there might be 500 million years of missing time there. Okay? And that's what their whole explanation of Earth history would lead them to consider. Yet, when you actually come here and look at this, it's nearly a featureless plain. It's not exactly a perfect plain, but it's a gently rolling surface. And would that be the product of billions of years of erosion, or would it be the product of the power of water? Planing off a surface? Time is almost irrelevant to a good explanation here, and so we really need to explain what we're actually seeing. Steve, everywhere we look, we see the incredible power of water, and it's water on a colossal scale, and that's really the main story here in the Grand Canyon. It's not a little bit of water and a whole lot of time. It's a lot of water in a relatively short amount of time. DL, time really is the central issue when we're talking about the history of the Earth. How much time did it actually take to form everything we see around us? It seemed pretty clear to me that a global flood would have transformed the Earth in a relatively short amount of time, yet I know so many people believe that the world formed slowly over billions of years. What was the actual real difference between these two very different views of time? I really needed to talk to someone who could tell me more about both science and history, and how they relate to time. Since my background is actually in computer science, we decided to meet at a place where I had personally experienced some of that history. As we looked around at the exhibit, I was struck by just how much smaller and more powerful computers had become since I first started using them. Paul explained that our changing assumptions about computers were actually a series of paradigm shifts. Paul, so when I was about 19 years old, I read Thomas Kuhn's classic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he describes this concept of paradigms. A paradigm is basically a framework that you use to interpret evidence. So, science isn't just about the raw evidence itself. It's about how you interpret that evidence. So, this room, for example, we've got these so-called mini computers here, but they're really not mini at all when compared to our current paradigm. DL, today, right? Paul, exactly today. So, to really understand this fundamental question of origins, you need to start by looking at the governing paradigms, the two major views that we currently have about the history of life and the history of the universe. DL. And what are those two major views? Paul, on the one hand, we have the conventional paradigm. In this conventional paradigm, you have what's called deep time, about 13.7 billion years, along which a gradual process occurs, beginning with primal simplicity and ending in everything we see today. All the complexity of life has to be built from the bottom up, by strictly physical processes where absolutely no mind, no creator, no design is present. Paul, the second view we can call, let's say, the historical Genesis paradigm. This paradigm suggests that everything starts with a divine mind, a creator, an intelligence that plans and oversees and brings into existence everything we see. And all of these events are happening on a much more recent timescale. The universe, the solar system, our planet, life itself, all of that begins fully formed as a functioning system. DL. It's pretty easy to see that there's a radical difference between those two in terms of time. Paul, when we look at the history of life on this planet, we've got a huge amount of data, but depending on the paradigm you adopt, that same data will be interpreted in very, very different ways. DL. It seems like one paradigm is drawing on a history that was given to us, and the other paradigm is actually constructing that history. Is that how you would describe it? Paul, well, we actually have a witness to all of those events, and that witness is telling us exactly what happened, and we have to take that into consideration when we're evaluating the data. DL, well, Paul, the reason this becomes so serious is that we're not just talking about the history of boiling water at a certain temperature. We're talking about a history that deals with the origin of the universe itself. It deals with the origin of all life, the origin of humanity, the origin of sin and why there's so much evil in the world, the origin of the geological formations that we see all around us, even the origin of language itself. I mean, this is a history that's not minor in any way. This is dealing with some major, major elements of humanity and where we are today. Paul, yeah, absolutely. You're really talking about the origin of literally everything. And I think if we zoom out from that a little bit and ask what the real difference between these two paradigms is, it's not really a question of science versus religion, because both of them are actually scientific in the sense that they're both looking at a common body of data. Really, at the deepest level, the difference is two fundamentally competing views of history. What is the true history of our cosmos? DL. That really does seem to be the central question. What is our true history? What actually really happened? The core conflict isn't between two views of science, but between two competing views of history. Since Genesis was originally written in Hebrew, I really wanted to talk to a Hebrew expert. What did the original text actually say? Stephen. The very first word in Genesis is, speaks Hebrew. Genesis 1 verse 1 is, speaks Hebrew. This is the beginning of the toldot of Noah. That word toldot is a very interesting word. It's sometimes translated as genealogies. Other times it's translated as history. And what follows then is the actual account of the flood. DL. Steve, it really seems like there's a lot of history contained in the Bible. Is that how you see it? Stephen, oh, absolutely. In fact, the most important thing to understand is that it's an accurate historical account. The presentation is very much from the perspective of the writers, and it's clear that they genuinely believed they were talking about real events. This is incredibly obvious because of the way in which they strongly insisted that the next generation learn their history. DL, when you look at those early chapters in Genesis, what do you actually see? Can you walk us through them a little bit? Stephen, it all starts with, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. There actually isn't a word in Hebrew for the universe. That really means that he created absolutely everything. And then the next thing we find in Genesis 1 verse 2 is a water ball that's just floating in space. And God, in the subsequent days, is going to fill that entire universe. DL, you're talking about these days here. Do you see these as actual, literal days? Is that what the text is trying to tell us? Or is it more like what some other people think, that this is just a poetic, different kind of view? Stephen, well, first of all, it's definitely not poetry. The world's greatest Hebraists all agree and affirm that this is a narrative. And they say that one of the unique features of the Genesis accounts of both the creation and the flood is that they are written as narratives, because in the ancient Near East, these kinds of accounts were typically done in epic poetry, which is very, very different. And here we have a clear narrative, indicating that this is meant to be historical. Stephen, what that means is that you should understand the words in the same normal way in which those Hebrew words were originally understood. The word yom simply means day, and the fundamental understanding of its usage is just what we mean by a day. a 24-hour day. The only way you'd want it to mean a longer period of time is if you're trying to impose some kind of alien concept onto the text and say, well, I think that these must be ages, and therefore, yam has to mean ages. What you really have to do is just start with the text itself. And if we start with the text, yam means day. DL, so when we get to the passage that talks about the creation of Adam and Eve, you're seeing that as a clear historical event, which would stand in direct opposition to the conventional paradigm that mankind evolved out of some long, drawn-out process. Stephen, the biblical text is simply not compatible with the standard conventional paradigm. The Bible teaches that the Lord God formed man, artistically breathing into him the breath of life, and then created him in his own image. And then, of course, woman is created. We have marriage. We have the fall. Then, in Noah's genealogy, we have the entire flood account, and is the flood a global flood? Well, I don't even know how many times. Maybe 35 times or so, the word kol, which means all, occurs in the flood narrative. If this is supposed to be a judgment on all of mankind, then it absolutely has to be global. And as we continue through these first 11 chapters of Genesis, we come to chapter 10, which is called the Table of the Nations, which are the sons of Noah. It mentions in that chapter that the people are in their different nations and speaking their different languages. So, Moses then goes back in Genesis 11 verses 1 to 9 and explains exactly how the languages developed. And so, we eventually come to the Toldot of Terah. And the Toldot of Terah isn't going to be about Terah at all. It's going to be about his famous son, Abraham. DL. It just seems so apparent that there's absolutely no disconnect between all of that and everything that we see at the very beginning. It's just one long, continuous historical narrative. Isn't it? Stephen, it absolutely is. As a matter of fact, the genealogies actually form the overall structure, not just for Genesis, but the narratives are embedded within those genealogies. The genealogies are actually picked up and called the Toldot in the book of Ruth to definitively establish that David is a descendant of Judah, which is specifically required by Jacob's prophecy. And then we move into the New Testament. How is the pedigree of Jesus actually established? With two clear genealogies, one going all the way back through Mary's line to Adam himself. DL. Steve, in light of everything that we've seen, how important is this historical narrative that we find throughout Genesis, including all of the generations that are laid out? How important is that to the core of Christianity? Stephen. It clearly shows that Christianity has a historical basis. It's exactly what the scriptures say, and the scriptures represent actual, genuine historical data. So, Christianity isn't just some leap in the dark. It's an understanding that has a very strong historical basis, and that our Savior is also our Creator. DL. These genealogies are just incredibly important. If Jesus is actually descended from Adam, and Adam was created on the sixth day of creation, then the earth simply can't be very old. So, where do all the millions of years actually come from? I met a geologist at a place where he said we could understand this a lot better. Andrew, you can really feel the quietness here, the expanse, with nothing around to disturb you. And yet, you're also reminded that this area was incredibly explosive in the past. There was a volcano right back here, a cinder cone volcano, and it belched out this massive lava flow that just spilled out across this entire countryside. DL. Just an absolutely huge amount of basalt lava. Andrew, yeah, but it's actually pretty small compared to some of the other lava flows that we see in a lot of other places. And there are literally thousands of these volcanoes scattered all around this area. And that little one right behind us, we just call that a cinder cone volcano. DL. You call that a little one? Andrew, yeah, well, it actually is. These volcanoes are pretty small. Mount St. Helens, when it erupted in 1980, the top 2,500 feet of the volcano actually blew off, but that was actually small compared to other historical eruptions. If we go back a little bit further to the Great Yellowstone eruption, some of the volcanic ash actually reached all the way down into Texas. It blew incredibly far away. And then if you think about the massive lava flows in India, where you have an accumulation of up to 1,000 feet of lava spread out over an area about a third of the size of the entire subcontinent of India. What we see in the present is really only minuscule in comparison to what has been seen in the past, and that's actually telling us something incredibly important about the historic past. We simply can't use present-day rates of these processes to fully understand how quickly and how majestically, in terms of scale, the geological record actually accumulated. DL, well, that's exactly the point that has brought me to you today, because how do we actually determine the age of these rocks? Andrew, well, the most important first thing is to recognize that this particular lava flow is, in a sense, an instant in time. It's a single event. And when it's still molten, you've got all the different elements that came out of the volcano all mixed up together, and then the rock actually starts to crystallize. Any of those atoms that happen to be radioactive, they now start to accumulate what we call the daughter products, the decay products. Now, the key point is that this rate of decay is so incredibly slow when we measure it in the present that it takes millions of years for parent atoms to break down into daughter atoms. Ultimately, that's where the millions of years figure comes from, the slow decay rates we observe today. DL. But shouldn't we acknowledge that the present isn't necessarily the key to understanding the past? The past clearly experienced massive, catastrophic events that simply aren't happening now. Andrew, actually, the Bible suggests that the past holds the key to the present. If you want to understand why the world is the way it is today, you need to understand what occurred in the past. We have numerous indications that geological processes haven't operated at consistent rates throughout history. We also have hints that decay rates might not have been constant either. We've collected rock samples from various locations, including numerous samples from each rock layer in the Grand Canyon. I've also done this in New Zealand and other parts of the world. We've submitted the same samples for dating using multiple methods. What we've discovered is that, when using different methods on the same samples, the age estimates often vary by hundreds of millions or even billions of years in some cases. We're seeing substantial discrepancies depending on the dating method used. DL. Well, if there's such a significant difference between all these dating methods, wouldn't that suggest that we're dealing with an open system, rather than a closed one? Andrew, exactly. And if it's an open system, we can't rely on it to provide accurate dates for these rocks. That completely changes how we understand the Earth's history, because suddenly these radioactive clocks become unreliable. We have evidence suggesting that decay rates were faster in the past. This means we might not need to think in terms of millions of years. We might be looking at a history that's much shorter. DL, you mentioned that this kind of evidence is now available in published scientific literature. Andrew, yes, it is. DL, so why isn't it having a greater impact? Andrew, I've been asked that question when speaking at university geology departments. The answer I get is that there's a deep-seated commitment to the millions of years time frame. Once people become entrenched in that perspective, anything outside of their viewpoint that contradicts it tends to be marginalized. The millions of years time frame is significant because, going back to the history of scientific thought, Charles Lyell in England proposed these vast ages, significantly multiplying the estimated ages of rocks. Charles Darwin built his theory upon that foundation. He read Lyell's book and became convinced of the immense geological timescales, which allowed him to argue that even if we only see small changes occurring in the present, given enough time, those small changes could accumulate into substantial transformations. If you want to explain the history of life through chance and random processes over millions of years, you need rocks that are millions of years old. Without that, the entire foundation of that worldview collapses. DL. So, time becomes the critical element for the conventional scientific understanding, and that time needs to be deep time. Andrew mentioned that, when studying rock formations, they reveal evidence of a young Earth that has been dramatically reshaped by a global catastrophe. He took me south to Sedona so I could see it for myself. Andrew, it's important to note that this landscape is actually quite stable now. There was a significant amount of erosion in the past that carved out this entire area. However, the cliffs and valley floor are now very stable, which is why you see vegetation. Today, things are much calmer. Current processes are incredibly slow, but they can't explain how this erosion occurred, how these layers formed, or how these cliffs came to be. DL. Okay, so you wanted to bring me here because you see evidence of a young Earth in what we're seeing around us. What specific evidence are you observing? Andrew. The first thing we notice is the sheer extent of these rock layers, like a stack of pancakes. For example, the red layer stretching across our entire field of vision is the Schneble Hill Formation. Above that, you see the first white layer, which is the Coconino sandstone. Above that is the Toroip formation, and on the horizon, you'll find the Kaibab limestone, which forms the rim rock of the Grand Canyon. We're 70 miles away from the Grand Canyon, and these layers are still present. DL. It's almost impossible to comprehend the sheer volume of material that represents. Andrew, consider the Coconino sandstone. We can trace it from here across New Mexico, Colorado, and even into Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. We're talking about at least 200,000 square miles for a single rock unit that maintains its consistency mile after mile. That's not the kind of localized sedimentation we see today. To get such a flat-lying deposit over such a vast area, it's like you have to create your pancake all at once very quickly. These layers provide evidence of rapid sedimentation due to their extent. DL. Well, Andrew, you mentioned that red formation, but that doesn't sound familiar to me. Andrew, that's the Schnebley Hill Formation. It's not present in the Grand Canyon. In the Grand Canyon, we transition directly from the Coconino Sandstone to the Hermit Formation. There's a sharp, distinct boundary with no signs of erosion. This suggests the Hermit Formation was deposited rapidly, and then the Coconino was deposited immediately on top of it. However, here, 70 miles away from the Grand Canyon, we find the Schnebley Hill Formation between the Coconino and the Hermit. This Schnebley Hill Formation, which is 800 to 1,000 feet thick and covers an area of 1,000 square miles, must have formed very quickly. If it took millions of years to form, we should see evidence of millions of years of erosion at that boundary in the Grand Canyon. But we don't. Therefore, the Schnebley Hill Formation in this area had to have formed within a matter of hours. This tells us that there's not only a lack of erosion, but there's also no significant time gap between the formation of these layers. The entire sequence of layers was deposited very rapidly. DL. So, we have the wide extent of the layers, the lack of erosion between them. What other evidence do you see? Andrew. If we look closely at the Coconino sandstone, for instance, we can see bedding or bands within it that are sloping. We call these crossbeds. These indicate the presence of underwater sand waves that were moving along. Comparatively, in a desert, the angle of these sloping beds is typically around 30 to 34 degrees. Underwater, it's usually 25 degrees or less. Dr. John Whitmore and his students have thoroughly examined the surrounding hills, taking hundreds of measurements of these crossbeds, and they consistently fall within the 15 to 25 degree range. This indicates underwater deposition. These layers accumulated in hours, weeks, and within months, you have this whole stack of pancake layers covering vast areas. DL. So, it's not a disagreement about the existence of these layers. Andrew, not at all. DL. It's a disagreement about the time frame, right? Andrew, exactly. It's not a question of science versus the Bible. When we discuss the flood paradigm versus the conventional paradigm, we're really talking about two distinct views of the Earth's history. DL. Those viewpoints are undeniably different. I was raised on the conventional view with its vast stretches of time and gradual, uniform changes. But what does the history of the world look like according to Genesis? DL. Kurt Wise took me from one fascinating location to another, showcasing evidence of fossil forests, explaining the rapid formation of coal, and discussing the complex design of biological systems. Everywhere we went, he showed me something new about the Earth and its history. We ended up at the entrance of an old, abandoned coal mine. Kurt, these are the remnants of the Dayton Coal and Iron Company, which was established about 100 to 110 years ago. DL, what's remarkable is that if you were unaware of that history and simply looked at these rocks, you might think they were incredibly ancient. If we were in Greece, you might even assume they were thousands of years old. Kurt, it's difficult to tell just by looking at the structure itself. DL. Well, Kurt, I need you to explain something, because I understand that the conventional scientific paradigm looks back at Earth's history as a linear progression of uniform processes. However, the Genesis account suggests a more complex, non-uniform history. Kurt. That's a great point. In 2 Peter, chapter 3, it talks about people in the last days who will ask, "Where is the promise of his coming? For all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation." This idea that what we see in the present, what's happening right now, in the creek down below or anywhere else on Earth, is how it's always been throughout Earth's history. The passage continues, "For this they are willingly ignorant. They are not simply unaware of these truths, but they are deliberately rejecting them," and it lists the creation and the flood as examples. According to the Bible, these are events that are unlike anything we experience today. The fascinating thing is, that's what we're seeing here. That cliff isn't actually in place. It belongs about 1,000 feet higher up. It slid down to its current location. DL, that's a pretty big boulder. Kurt, it's massive, absolutely huge. And this continues for a mile. But inside those rocks, there's even more evidence of an even bigger, even more unusual event that predates this. And inside those rocks, we also find fossils from a period of time that was vastly different from the present. So, based on the claims of Scripture and my personal experience, you can't use the present to understand the past. If you go all the way back to the beginning, you see that the Bible outlines what I would call epochs of Earth history. DL, major periods of time. Kurt, different things happening during each of these epochs. If you lived in one of the other epochs, you wouldn't be able to comprehend the previous one because it would be so different. The first epoch is creation itself. In 6 days, God created the entire universe. He created the planets and the stars and stretched out the universe with his outstretched arm. Obviously, that's not happening today. He's not creating planets. In fact, at the end of that passage, it says he ended his creation work. Kurt, then we move into what I call the Edenian epoch, the period of time when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden. That world was very different from the present. We get the impression from the passage that Adam and Eve, if they hadn't sinned, would have lived forever. It's hard to even imagine human beings living forever. So, it's a different world, wildly different. How long it lasted, we don't know. But it's abruptly terminated when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and God cursed the creation. He changed the rules in the universe. The sun wouldn't burn forever, and we wouldn't be able to live forever. DL. So, it's difficult for us to even imagine what those times were like because we only see the laws that govern the present. Kurt. And we wouldn't have reached that conclusion without the Word of God. DL. That's true. Kurt. That's what I believe the Word of God has been given to us for. So, we transition into the third epoch of time, which I call the antediluvian period, the period before the flood but after the fall of man. It's a world that's different from the present. It has the same natural laws operating, but it has a different set of creatures, a different set of plants. The earth is a little bit warmer. The continents are in different positions than they are now. It looks significantly different. DL. And that's what we see in Peter, where it talks about that world being destroyed. So the flood wasn't just a soaking of everything. It was a radical, radical change, wasn't it? Kurt. If we're correct in our understanding so far, we're talking about continents moving and smashing together, creating mountains that rise to tens of thousands of feet. Water is washing across entire continents, ripping away tens of thousands of feet of sediment from the old continents and then depositing thousands of feet of sediment on top of them again. We're talking about earthquakes of astonishing power. DL, so, this then changed from what you call the antediluvian epoch into the post-flood epoch. Kurt. Basically, the earth had to recover from a global flood. The atmosphere had to recover. The geology and the rocks had to recover. Plants and animals had to spread across the earth. There was lots of water, enormous earthquakes, huge volcanoes. That period of recovery was characterized by a slow decrease in the intensity and frequency of those events. DL, so, would we see the Ice Age during that period, for example? Kurt, yes, ironically, in our modeling, the Ice Age turns out to be a consequence of the heating of the water during the flood. The water evaporating from the oceans cooled the oceans. That water then moved over the continents, dropping enormous volumes of water. In certain places, the rain fell as snow, but it fell so rapidly and continuously that it couldn't melt and accumulated into thick sequences of ice that were miles thick. When the oceans had cooled enough to stop that rain generation system, those glaciers collapsed under their own weight, melted back to their current position, and are still melting. So this whole global warming thing is really the Earth still recovering from the flood. DL. So that was a fairly tumultuous era, but then you have one final epoch. Kurt. The modern epoch is where you can study present-day processes and understand things fairly readily back to within a couple of centuries of the flood. DL, and so, that would lead one to think that these processes, if you take them all the way back. Kurt. Precisely. You take the present processes and extend them into the past, and that's what 2 Peter says. That's the error people make. It's reasonable to take the present and extend it into the past, but it's not correct. You need to go to the Bible to find the necessary information to reconstruct it. Looking at it the other way, if you start from the Bible, you only get the beginning of the story. God has given us the ability to read the rocks and fill in the rest of the story, and we need to in order to fully understand the flood. We start with the Bible, but then we go to the rocks. Speak to the rocks, and they shall tell you what has happened in the past. D.L. Kurt made a good point. The Bible records historical events, but it doesn't explain how those events happened. That's what these scientists are doing. They're trying to interpret the evidence in light of biblical history. Kurt mentioned that there was evidence inside the rocks. What was that evidence? Marcus. I love coming to natural history museums. As a paleontologist, it's like visiting a zoo filled with the animals that lived before the flood. It's like stepping back in time. DL. It's like a zoo, except they're not alive. They're all dead. Marcus. And they don't smell, which is a plus. The Natural History Museum doesn't just tell us what was there. It also tries to give us a storyline, and we have two options. A naturalistic view and a biblical view. Natural history museums around the country, and most around the world, present only one of those views, offering just a naturalist old earth perspective. But the same data, like this dinosaur, can be understood within an alternate paradigm. When I look at these creatures, I envision a world right before the flood. DL. I mean, this is a real picture of a violent world. Marcus. Yeah. That's why God said, "Behold, the end of all flesh." It wasn't just mankind. Man and all the animals over which we rule were judged at the time of the flood. DL. Well, Marcus, can you give us an overview of the fossils and how it all fits together? Marcus. Fossils tend to be found in distinct layers where immense numbers of organisms have been destroyed, untold billions. Every time we see a rock layer of this thickness, we think of an event that probably took minutes to create, not thousands of years. Minutes for just this one package of rock. Sometimes even seconds. These pulses of water from the flood moved over the continents, grabbing ecosystems and dragging marine ecosystems up from the deeper ocean and pulling them onto land. As one layer gets deposited, the waves return, pulling and piling additional material on top of it. It's a graveyard on top of a graveyard on top of a graveyard. This speaks to catastrophe, not the gradual accumulation of bone by bone, shell by shell, over untold eons of time. DL, so, you're saying that we have marine fossils everywhere, even on mountains? Marcus, yes. Further back in the museum, they have sections with mosasaurs, these large swimming reptiles. Mosasaurs are found globally, distributed across continents. Looking at these things, you have to ask what force has the power, what has the capacity to take the marine world and throw it on top of the continents in such a violent and destructive manner. The flood makes perfect sense in this context. DL. When we were in the Grand Canyon, we observed that great unconformity, where there were hardly any fossils below it, and then suddenly we start seeing a lot. What does that tell you as a paleontologist? Marcus. The great unconformity tells me that there was massive erosion and shearing occurring across the continent. Once we reach those nice sedimentary rocks with the wonderful fossils, a pattern starts to emerge. The ecosystem containing the first animals appears very suddenly. In conventional paleontology, they call this the Cambrian explosion. It's the first appearance of a wide diversity of different types of marine animals. Suddenly, there's a complex and complete ecosystem that appears seemingly out of nowhere. This makes perfect sense from a creation and flood perspective because the flood is about destroying ecosystems. In an evolutionary view, these ecosystems would have to arise more gradually as organisms diversify, evolve, and respond to one another in their environment. But that's not what we see. Instead, we see an explosion of life that's complex, complete, and the ecosystem is integrated. You can see how all the different organisms fit together. This pattern repeats itself as you move up the geological column in the fossil record. You see snapshots of more and more ecosystems. One ecosystem gets destroyed, and then you have another with slightly different creatures and interactions. As the floodwaters rise higher and higher, they get closer to shore, destroying more and more organisms on the shoreline and eventually moving onto the land. DL. So, I think I understand what you're saying. The paradigm we're taught, the conventional paradigm, tries to tell us that the fossil record is an evolutionary picture of life as it develops. However, the Genesis paradigm says that all of that life, all of the complexity of life was already there. We're just looking at the graveyard of that life. Marcus. Exactly. DL. What other data convinces you of this paradigm? Marcus. One very curious situation in the fossil record involves not the hard parts of the animals, but the trackways, their footprints. This is a pattern we see in several different groups, where the footprints appear first, and the body parts appear later. For trilobites, amphibians, and dinosaurs, the first evidence we find in the fossil record is trackways, not hard parts. From an old Earth perspective, that's really weird and hard to explain because it implies millions of years between the trackway production and the appearance of the animal that made it. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense because if there are trackways, there are animals and those animals have bones, teeth, and shells. Why aren't they fossilized? Instead, the pattern is telling us something different. There's no time between when an animal leaves a track and when it gets buried. DL. The fact that those trackways are still there tells us something as well, doesn't it? Marcus. It tells us that the deposition of the next layer on top of them had to happen very, very quickly. If you go to a beach and walk in the sand, your trackways are destroyed very quickly. But the fossil record shows us something very different from today. This is death in a moment, death in an instant. We're talking about a world that was complex, complete, and integrated, and the flood is sequentially destroying that world and burying it vertically. So, when we look at the fossil record as a record of life, that's partially accurate, but it's not really about how life developed. It's more about life's struggle to survive a cataclysmic event that ultimately wiped them all out. DL. Well, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Because when God talked about destroying the earth with the flood, he wasn't just talking about wiping out humans, it was the destruction of all life. And that means the world we live in now is, like you said, radically different from what it was before. Marcus. Right. When we see a T-Rex or a Mosasaur or any of those creatures, yeah, they look like ferocious carnivores and they are, I mean, they're terrifying. But that wasn't what they were originally created to be. Those razor-sharp teeth, those devastating claws, and the behaviors that go with them. It all seems to be part of the curse. And part of that's genetic, sure. But some of it might just be modifications, too. The key thing to remember is that these organisms, by the time we find them, and this is super important when you're visiting a natural history museum, you're not looking at the world as it was during creation week. You're looking at the world after the flood. And that world was filled with violence, a pretty terrible place to be. DL. It struck me that the billions of creatures entombed in those layers of rock are like a silent testament to God's global judgment. And I knew I had to see one of those fossil layers for myself. If the dinosaurs really did die suddenly in the flood, wouldn't that be obvious? Art, what we're working with here is part of the Lance Formation. It's an upper Cretaceous sedimentary deposit. And what we've got is what's called a bone bed. Basically, it's an accumulation of bones about a meter thick, actually, a little less than a meter. Within that meter, the bones are arranged as a graded bed, with the smaller bones at the top and the bigger bones at the bottom. You can see here that Erlein's working on another vertebrae. That's a cervical vertebra from a duck-billed dinosaur. The spinal cord would have run right through there. When I look at these bones in the quarry, I often try to imagine what it was like when they were inside a living animal, try to see it as if I'm looking at them for the very first time. Art. Yeah, this is just packed with bones. It's not like we have to go searching for them. We just sit down and start digging. DL. What's the main difference between the sites you're excavating here and a more general dinosaur dig somewhere else? Art. Well, dinosaur remains are found all over the globe, but this particular site is unique because it's probably one of the biggest collections of bones anywhere. We're talking about the remains of, I'd estimate, between 5 and 10,000 animals, each one 20 to 40 feet long, all in this one deposit. These are big animals, and there are a lot of them. DL, let's back up for a sec. Okay, so you've got a duck-billed dinosaur wandering around the Earth, and then, boom, it dies. Would it automatically turn into a fossil? Art, fossilization requires very specific conditions. Normally, you know, if a coyote dies out in the desert, its body is gone pretty quickly. But these bones are almost perfectly preserved. They've never been exposed to the elements. They're just there. It's really hard to imagine how that could happen under normal circumstances today. DL, so, in general, would you say that finding a fossil is a rare event? I mean, even though we have tons of fossils overall, is it rare for an animal that dies to become fossilized? Art, it is rare. It needs specific conditions, and one of the most important is rapid burial. These animals had to die, and then their bodies had to have time to decompose a bit. We're talking days, weeks, or months, while the soft tissues were either eaten away or decayed. And then the remaining bones were deposited almost instantly in this environment. You can see that because they're in a grated bed with the big bones at the bottom and the small bones at the top. As they dig up here, they start to find smaller bones. That arrangement implies a sorting process that can only happen during a catastrophic event. DL. So when you look at dinosaur fossils, instead of arranging them from early to middle to late dinosaurs, you look at them as if they all coexisted. They were all alive at the same time, and then this enormous catastrophe brought everything to an end. Art, dinosaurs are already dinosaurs when they first show up. They look exactly like you'd expect a dinosaur to look. That's a real head-scratcher for those who believe in dinosaur evolution. DL. But we hear so much about transitional forms. What's the real story there? Art, scientists have proposed some forms that they believe are transitional, and some of them are interesting, even compelling. But those are the exceptions to the rule. The rule is, there aren't really any transitional fossils. What we find in the fossil record, and this is the opposite of what Darwin hoped for, is that a form appears suddenly, pretty much stays unchanged, and then it disappears from the fossil record without having changed. That has to mean something other than evolution, because we never see gradual changes from one form to another in the rocks themselves. Art. So it's like it's coming from somewhere else. It's a paradigm that's being forced onto the data instead of the data leading to the paradigm. That's why it's so easy for me to be a creationist, based on my understanding of how incredibly complex life is. When we look at the fossil record, that complexity is there right from the start. And that raises the question, where did it all come from? It's one thing to have faith. I have faith that God was the creator, but that faith is backed up by what I see all around me. But to say that I have faith that evolution produced all this, when I can't even imagine how it could have happened, that's just blind faith. DL. That's a leap in the dark. Art. Exactly, a leap in the dark. DL. It seemed like everywhere I looked, I was finding more and more evidence that lined up with the historical account in Genesis. It wasn't just one thing, it was multiple things all pointing in the same direction. When I was with Art, he told me about some recent discoveries of original material inside dinosaur bones. So I traveled to a lab in Arizona to talk to a scientist who's actually doing some of that research himself. Kevin, this is a fragment of a Triceratops horn. When we dug it out of the ground, it crumbled. And, of course, we've had to continue to break it apart in order to do our analyses. In 2012, the Creation Research Society funded Mark Armitage and me to go to the Hell Creek Formation in Montana, which is a very well-known spot for finding dinosaur bones. Instead of just any bone, we dug up an almost 4-foot-long Triceratops brow horn. It's in pieces now, unfortunately, so we can't put it all together to show you the full horn. But you have to understand that within pieces like this, we've found actual tissue with cells inside. DL. Wow. That's incredible. Kevin, and potentially proteins like collagen. It's hard to wrap your head around how this material could possibly still be present in a dinosaur fossil that's supposed to be 65, 75, 80 million years old. Because tissue, cells, proteins, they break down. They're not concrete. They don't just hang around for eons. They decay, and they tend to decay fairly quickly depending on the conditions. And in Hell Creek, the conditions are anything but stable warm-up, cool down, warm up, cool down. Any biochemist will tell you that's the quickest way to degrade organic material. It's hard enough to believe it could last for 4 or 5,000 years, but 60 million, 70 million years? It's almost impossible to find a scientific explanation for how it could have survived. DL, okay, so you find a sample like this. What do you do next? Kevin, the first thing we do is soak the fossil material in a solution called EDTA. That dissolves away the fossil, leaving the tissue behind. Because EDTA doesn't dissolve tissue. Then, I put it under what we call a dissection microscope. This is basically dissolved Triceratops horn, magnified so you can see what it looks like. Mostly just little pieces of rock. DL. So, Kevin, what did you find when you looked at the sample and you actually found some tissue? Kevin, okay, well, here's what we found. This is actual Triceratops tissue. It's stretchable, it's pliable. It's not just an impression of the dinosaur's soft parts. It's genuinely soft. It's squishy. It's stretchable. It is tissue. DL. That must blow your mind. Kevin. Absolutely. And when you look at it under higher magnification using a scanning electron microscope, you can see the unbelievable detail of the cells in this picture, and especially this one. We would never expect to see this level of detail. I mean, these structures are incredibly small. This scale bar here is 20 microns, which gives you an idea of just how tiny these structures are, and they're still intact. It wouldn't take much to break them. You'd expect that it would have all broken off and been gone a long time ago. DL. This must have really shaken up the scientific community. What's been the reaction to all of this? Kevin, the initial reaction when Dr. Schweitzer first published her work, which became really well known around 2005, was, well, it generated a lot of debate. Initially, some people flat out rejected it. They said it was just contamination, that it wasn't really dinosaur tissue, that it was just bacteria, because bacteria can sometimes look strange. So, there were a lot of theories about what it could be. To her credit, Dr. Schweitzer kept digging. They started finding proteins. If you break open some of these cells, you can look at the matrix they're attached to, and it is protein. DL. Okay, so once that's understood, then what happens? I mean, that has to stir things up, right? Kevin. That's where the controversy really starts, because you're suddenly faced with the question of how you can explain the survival of this pristine survival, not only for so long, but in such unstable conditions. Kevin. And so the controversy has boiled down to, how do you explain it? If you read some of the scientific papers, you can almost sense the desperation because they understand the implications of this. Now, some people might claim, well, it doesn't mean anything because we know how old they are and therefore it must have just survived somehow. Big deal. But how do you know how old they are? You're using certain dating methods. Well, this is a dating method too. The tissue itself can't be ignored as part of the dating process. So why do you say that this doesn't count, but that does? Well, because the underlying paradigm drives your conclusions. The paradigm says it has to be old, so any methods that give us an old fossil are the ones we choose. Anything that doesn't give us an old fossil, like tissue, we have to reject or try to explain away. DL, at least to me, and of course I'm not a microbiologist, but I think most people would find it more reasonable to think that maybe these fossils aren't as old as we thought. Kevin, exactly. It completely undermines the dating process. If dinosaur fossils have been dated incorrectly, and I'd say this is clear evidence that they have, then it's highly likely that the fossils of any organism have been dated incorrectly. And if that's the case, then the entire geologic timescale is wrong. DL, what you're saying is that if you take away the idea of vast amounts of time, you're pulling out a major foundation for the conventional paradigm. Kevin, absolutely. Time is absolutely critical for evolution. If you're going to claim that a simple cellular system became a multicellular system, which then became fish, and the fish then crawled up onto land, grew legs, started breathing air, and then that creature grew feathers and wings and started flying, if you give us enough time, we claim we can account for all of that massive change in organisms. But we have to have the time. DL. It seemed like everything kept coming back to the question of time. I remembered Andrew saying that Charles Darwin accepted millions of years first, and then he fit his theory of evolution to that assumption. But why is time such an important element to evolution? DL. Rob Carter is a marine biologist, so he took me scuba diving to give me a glimpse of a world most people never get to see. His specialty is coral, and he knows a lot about the amazing creatures that live on the reefs around St. Thomas. DL, wow, there are sharks down here. Look at how they move, gliding along so effortlessly. I wish I could swim like that. ROB, engineers wish they could make boats like that. Submarines that could move as efficiently as a shark. We're not quite there yet. DL, from your perspective as a marine biologist, and I know you've studied genetics a lot, when people talk about evolution, what do they actually mean? ROB, how do you define evolution? The word itself just means change over time. I believe in change over time, but I don't call myself an evolutionist. So how do you figure that out? Really, evolution is the belief that enough change over enough time can lead to the common ancestry of all species on Earth. That's the part one reject. Of course, species change. I mean, look at these sharks here. We have several different species of sharks. When God created, he put into those organisms the ability to change, to adapt, to respond dynamically to the environment. But they're still sharks. And when we look at the fossil record, they're still sharks. People have heard the phrase, the missing link, and they usually think of the link between a man and a monkey. No, there are missing links between almost every major group of animal and almost every other major group of animal and plant and bacteria all the way through the fossil record. And that strongly suggests that these are actually different creations. DEL. So we don't get one kind of creature becoming another kind? ROB, no. Evolution theory says that small, random changes can explain everything we see. But it can't. DL. And why can't it? ROB. Because life is so incredibly complex that small changes just aren't enough to explain it. It's like you can't just pick up a computer operating system and say, oh yeah, this all just built up one digit at a time, over an unlimited amount of time. No, it took an intelligent person to sit down and put it all together. DL. I can tell you, as someone who used to work in that world, if anyone in computer science were to suggest that we could just randomly change some things in an operating system and it would get better, no one would agree with that. ROB, no way. We're not going to get a shark to evolve into a bird. The number of changes and the types of changes are not something you can accomplish one change at a time. ROB, this is a sea urchin. DL, it looks spiny. ROB, it is spiny. You have to be careful. DL, am I going to get poked if I touch it? ROB, no, he's pointy. But, DL, oh my goodness, they're moving. ROB, yes, they're moving. And in between the spines are little tube feet, especially on the bottom. Look at that movement. So he walks with his spines and these little tube feet, and he uses those to grab onto things. If you look closely, you'll see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are actually 10 radial parts to this animal. DL, huh. ROB, actually, the starfish is his cousin. DL, are you serious? You can't be serious. ROB, absolutely. The starfish here is also an echinoderm, but notice that it has fivefold symmetry instead of 10. The starfish does. On the bottom, look, we see the spines. We see the tube feet. His mouth is in the center there. DL, so there is some similarity here, even though they look pretty different on the outside. ROB, very different. You want to see something that looks really different? DL, sure. ROB, which is a cousin to both the starfish and the sea urchin? DL, okay. It almost looks like a rock. ROB, yes, it does. I have to be careful. He's squirting on me. This is a sea cucumber. He has spines. He has tube feet. You'd never know, unless you studied it really hard, that this is also an echinoderm. He's not very happy being out of the water, so let me put him back in. DL. So these are all related, even though they look so different. ROB, related in their creation. Not in an evolutionary sense. But our creator took this phylum of life, the echinoderms, and created this and this and this based on a similar pattern. And that's what we see across the entire realm of life. Similarities and differences. DL. So what makes them different? ROB. Well, genetically they share most of their genes in common, but there are developmental genes called Hox genes that set up these patterns in the animal as it develops. They all develop from a single cell. In one of them, those genes set up a fivefold symmetry. In another, they set up a tenfold symmetry. Another one, they make this long skinny animal. They control the development of the embryo in these amazing ways. DL, you're saying that when we look at this from a molecular or genetic perspective, we're seeing a fascinating design in all of this. ROB. Absolutely. DL. But the conventional story tells us that it's just those random changes that have brought all of this about. ROB, sure. Back in the 1800s, when life seemed simpler, when they didn't know what was happening inside the cell, when they didn't know how complex genetics was, you could imagine all sorts of things. But now that we know what's actually happening behind the scenes, the story gets a lot more complicated. The genome is four-dimensional. We have a one-dimensional string called DNA. If you wanted to draw that out completely, you'd have to write out all the letters of the DNA, all 3 billion of them. And then you'd have to draw lines or arrows from one part to another because this part turns this part off, this part interferes with this, this part enhances this. It's this huge two-dimensional interaction network, and that's how you get a two-dimensional genome. DL, let me stop you for a second because that's amazing to think about. I tend to think of a computer program as fairly static. The instructions are just there. But you're talking about a program that's actually reprogramming itself. It's modifying its own instructions. ROB. Oh, wait until I get to the fourth dimension because there's a third dimension first. The information in that first dimension, that linear string, has to be organized in such a way that when it folds into the third dimension, it still works. DL, wow, that's incredible. ROB. Genes that are used together are located next to each other in three-dimensional space. DL. Are you saying that once this thing gets folded up, it's almost like we have a new set of instructions? ROB. Exactly. A new level of information. And whoever programmed that first level needed to understand what was going to happen in order for it to work in the third level. DL. You said there's another dimension. ROB. Oh yeah, the fourth dimension is time. DL. And how does that work? ROB. The genome changes shape over time. Maybe you eat something that's bad for you and your liver says, I can get rid of that toxin. Now the chromosomes in the liver will change shape, expose that new protein gene, make copies of it, and build a brand new protein that can break down that toxin. And when it's not needed anymore, they'll change shape again and fold back. It's dynamic programming, all three levels changing in the fourth level, time. DL, Rob, that's so far beyond anything we have, even in our most complex software systems. It's almost impossible to believe that someone could look at that and say it all happened by chance. ROB, yes, and it only brings glory to God. DL, it really does. ROB, you can't build something like that one thing at a time. You need it to function in all its interlocking four-dimensional complexity. It's not something you can do one letter at a time with natural selection. DL, it all has to be there. ROB, yeah. It's the same way we talked about the environment out here on the coral reef. If you don't have all these interlocking pieces of the puzzle, you don't have a functioning ecology. The system will collapse if you just remove a couple of very important factors. They all have to be together or it doesn't happen. DL. So not only do we have this interdependency, this mutualism, so to speak, at the genetic level, but we even make it more complex by saying there's the same kind of mutualism at a higher level as well. ROB, yes. In fact, the entire world has a mutualism. DL. It's impossible to imagine that all of this could have happened just through a series of slow processes over billions of years. ROB. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. DL. It's clear that the world we live in is unbelievably interdependent, from the smallest biological system to the largest ecosystem. There are complex, mutual relationships everywhere. I realized that creation in 6 days makes the most sense from an engineering perspective. You need everything working together at the same time for everything to function properly. And that's exactly how Genesis says God created it. Rob also pointed out that God created animals with the ability to change and adapt to their environments. Is it possible that this ability to change has been mistaken for evolution? DL, as Todd Wood. I continued my walk through the zoo, and everywhere I looked, I was struck by the incredible beauty and amazing designs. I couldn't help but notice the vast differences between some animals and the striking similarities of others. DL, as a biologist, what do you see when you observe all these creatures? Todd, Well, when I look at them, specifically these lions, I see cats. And all the other cats here at the zoo. They all share this fundamental catness that's really obvious. It's especially noticeable when they start playing, right? When you see them playing with a ball or something, they just look. DL. They're just like a house cat. Todd. Exactly, they look just like a house cat. Scientists would classify them into a family called Felidae. And I view the felids as representatives of a single created kind. The continuity, the similarity among them is so significant that I would argue they all descended from a single pair of animals that were on the ark, and that pair eventually generated all the different types of cats we have today. DL. So rather than a random accident, it seems as if all these different species are derived from a really elaborate design. Todd. Oh, absolutely. And it's not just a design where God designed and created the lion as a one-off thing. It's more like God created something that could make a lion. It's more like a multi-tool or a Swiss Army knife, where you've got all these pieces that you can pop out whenever you need them, but it's all still just one thing. DL. Can you give me some other examples of these created kinds? Todd. Sure, you've got grizzlies and polar bears. They're all members of the bear kind. And then you have ducks, swans, and geese. The thing about the dog kind is particularly interesting. You take a wolf-like creature, and we can breed it into many different breeds in just a few hundred years. DL, well, Todd, it's fascinating to think about what God was doing when he was bringing two of every kind onto the ark. What do you think was going on there? Todd, he didn't need to bring every single little variety onto the ark. When you do the calculations, and we don't know exactly how many created kinds there were on the ark, maybe a couple of thousand, and they're mostly small animals. So there was room to spare, literally room to spare, and all the diversity we see today was built into those two of every kind. DL. Well, Todd, we're looking at these zebras, and they're all unique, and yet with all these creatures, there's just so much complexity and diversity. How does the standard evolutionary story, the conventional paradigm, explain all of that? Todd, well, they would use evolution, right? Millions of years, random variations. Everything that's alive now, that cactus, that zebra, the grass, it's all related. We all go back to a common ancestor that lived billions of years ago, and through mutation, genetic variation, and natural selection, we get the diversity we see today. DL. So, natural selection, what is it, and does it have the creative potential needed to generate all of this? Todd. Natural selection is basically about killing off the things that aren't well suited for their environment. If you're a finch in the Galapagos with a tiny beak, and the only food available is big, hard seeds, you're going to die. And that's exactly what we observe. We can watch over generations as the beak size of finches changes in the Galapagos. But they're still finches. They're still birds. The idea that natural selection can generate all the diversity we see hasn't been demonstrated. What we find most often is that natural selection does a lot of fine-tuning. Todd. Right here, we've got these oryx, beautiful creatures with very pale coloration. The wild range of the oryx is at the southern end of the Sahara Desert. So their coloration makes perfect sense. If you had a really dark-colored oryx, it would be easy for predators to spot, so they end up being these beautiful light colors. That's an example of where selection takes a variation and turns it into an adaptation. DL. And that brings us back to the idea that a really exquisite design in the beginning. Todd. I think so, absolutely. DL. Has provided these creatures with the ability to survive and change for their benefit. Todd. Absolutely. The ability to change your coloration like that, to fit in an environment, has to be built into the system from the start. Now, don't get me wrong. Natural selection and random variation can do amazing things. It's astonishing the kinds of changes we can see. But we don't see one kind changing into another kind. All we see are variations within a created kind. So there's the felid tree, which has all the cats on it. There's the canid tree with all the dogs. The ursid tree with all the bears. The equid tree with all the horses. Each individual created kind has its own individual tree, so you end up with something like an orchard or a forest. DL, as a scientist, it sounds like you're saying that the Genesis paradigm explains all this data better. Todd, ultimately, I think it does, because it embraces both similarity and difference. As we've already said, there are still a lot of unanswered questions. But I'm confident, given what our paradigm can explain, that those answers will be found. DL. After we left the zebras, we headed over to the gorillas. Todd wanted to talk about the question of human evolution. DL. Todd, we see new discoveries all the time, new skulls, new skeletons, that supposedly solidify the idea of human evolution. What do you make of all that? Todd. I actually have some examples right here in my bag. DL. Ooh, a skull. Todd. This is a Neanderthal. Notice the very low forehead. We have really tall foreheads. The midface is pulled out, but overall it looks very human. That's a Neanderthal. Wanna hold that one? DL, sure. Todd. Now, we have others that are very different. This one is Australopithecus africanus. You can see there's almost no forehead at all. It just slopes straight back. Very small brain case, and the muzzle sticks way out, so the face is sloped forward. What do you make of this stuff? There are many more we could show. More pictures, more skulls. And when you look at them together, there are a lot of differences. Here's the thing, though. All that stuff we talked about with created kinds, I can demonstrate again and again with multiple studies that I can find a clear discontinuity between humans and non-humans. Todd. This Neanderthal, he's one of us. This Australopithecus, not so much. It's different. It's just another variety of living thing that God made in the beginning, and it did not survive the flood aboard the Arkansas DEL. So when we look at Neanderthals, we're looking at a human, but like dogs, we have a lot of variety among humans. Todd, we've got a lot of variety of people. Even looking back at the gorilla, we can see obvious differences between us, not the least of which is that he's in there, and we get to go home when we're done. DL. And those differences are really huge, aren't they? Todd. Absolutely. The image of God implies this idea of being God's representative here on earth. Part of that involves having dominion and authority, a spiritual quality that we possess but don't share with animals like that. DL. It's obvious we're different from the rest of creation because we're made in God's image. We're the only ones who create zoos so we can see the beauty of God's animals. And we're unique in tracking time and wanting to know our own history. But where does our concept of time come from? DL. It was a beautiful night. Danny took me far outside the city and kept me up very late to show me something unforgettable. DL. Oh my goodness. Now you're gonna make me buy a telescope. Laughter. Danny, you know, the stars were created for specific purposes. In Genesis 1 verses 14 to 19, the account of creation on day 4 mentions that the stars and other heavenly bodies were created to mark time, to rule over the night, and to serve as signs for seasons and festivals. People have used the stars to mark the passage of time for centuries. The patterns repeat every night, every year. They come back in their season. There's a lot of regularity to them. DL, what about the design of the sun and the moon? Danny, there are a couple of things I could mention. On rare occasions, the moon passes between us and the sun. It doesn't happen very often, and when it does, the moon just barely covers the sun. If the moon were a little smaller or a little farther away, it wouldn't happen at all. If it were larger or closer, it would completely block the sun. These eclipses are spectacular and rare, and Earth is the only planet where this happens in such a way. You have to think, is that just the way the world is for no reason? Or is the world designed that way for a purpose? To me, that speaks of creation. Danny, okay, high overhead here we have the Great Square of Pegasus. It's this big rectangle. Coming off of Pegasus, there's a little fuzzy spot right there. Do you see it? That's the Andromeda Galaxy. It's the most distant object you can see with the naked eye. It's a little over 2 million light years away, and it contains a couple of 100 billion stars. DL. Okay, Danny, that brings me to a big question that a lot of people have. If we have stars that are millions of light years away, and if the Earth is young, as we believe, how is it possible for the starlight to be here? Danny. Yeah, we call this the light travel time problem. Let me phrase it a little differently. We believe that creation is only thousands of years old. Say, 6,000 or 7,000 years. And I just pointed out something that we think is 2 million light years away from us. I think those distances are reasonably accurate, and we creationists need to address this question. We've proposed several different solutions. I'll share my solution with you, Danny. Several things stand out to me in the creation account. One is that there was a lot of rapid process involved. If you look at the account of day three, it talks about plants rising up out of the ground. It says, let the earth bring forth these plants. And the earth did. I think if you'd been there, it would have looked like a time-lapse movie. Growth that might normally take decades happening in minutes or hours. It was normal growth, but abnormally fast. Danny, I believe you can interpret one day of creation in terms of another day. So I turn to the day four account. Not much information is given there, but I think God also rapidly made the stars and other astronomical bodies. Then, in order for them to fulfill their function, to be seen, he had to rapidly bring forth that light. Just as he brought plants forth and matured them quickly, he had to bring the light here. I'm suggesting we're looking at light that actually left those objects, like the Andromeda galaxy we saw a few minutes ago. So I think a rapid maturing took place. DL, Danny, are there other things that point to a young universe? Danny, I think so. For instance, spiral galaxies. The Andromeda galaxy we discussed is a spiral galaxy, and so is our own. The inner parts of these galaxies spin faster than the outer parts. After a few rotations, those spiral patterns should wind up or smear out. They ought to disappear, but most astronomers think spiral galaxies are 10 billion years old, so why do we still see spiral patterns? It's been long recognized as a problem. Danny, if we look at the outer planets of the solar system, the gas giants, they all have rings. We know these rings are changing. They're being wiped out. Changes within the ring systems have actually been documented. There are all these gravitational tugs from the other satellites orbiting around. So these ring systems are fairly young. It doesn't prove that the solar system is young, but it proves that these ring systems are young, and that's interesting. DL, well, you've mentioned a lot of theories about the spirals and so forth, which brings us to what most people see as the big theory concerning cosmology and the universe, the Big Bang. What do you think about it? Is it holding up over time? Danny, I don't think so. It's encountering some serious problems, so much so that over a dozen years ago, in New Scientist magazine, there was an open letter protesting the Big Bang theory, and it's garnered hundreds of signatures since. Most of the signatories are atheists, not even creationists. So the idea that the Big Bang model is universally accepted isn't true. There are many well-known people, famous physicists and astronomers, who have real problems with the Big Bang. And I don't see any way to reconcile the Big Bang with the Bible, though many people seem to think you can. Danny, the temptation is to try to interpret scripture in terms of current cosmological thinking. That's nothing new. This happened before with disastrous results. So when you look at the history of science, the way we've discarded theories over time, theories that were supposedly beyond dispute, and then later discarded, when you see that lesson from history, and then you want to wed Genesis to interpret Genesis in terms of a ruling paradigm, I think you need to be very careful. DL, I realize Danny was reorienting our perspective. We need to interpret the universe in terms of Genesis, not the other way around. And Genesis tells us that God created the sun, moon, and stars to be a magnificent clock to track the passage of time. Even the ancients built towers to follow the stars. But what does Genesis say about those people and the languages they spoke? DL, Doug took me to one of the best archaeological museums in the world to show me some unique artifacts that relate to Genesis. Doug, the events of the Bible unfolded in the ancient Near East. So all these lands are extremely important for understanding how and what took place in the biblical text. DL, this ties into the events we've been exploring in Genesis, from creation and the flood to the dispersion of mankind from Noah and his family. Doug, exactly. The dispersion would have taken place somewhere in the mountains to the northwest of Mesopotamia. The biblical narrative tells us that a number of people migrated down to southern Mesopotamia, the land of Shinar, and began the process of urbanization of city living. DL, and that's the famous Tower of Babel. Doug, absolutely. DL, do we know where that was located? Doug, there are about 7 or 8 cities named Babel in ancient Mesopotamia. I've studied all of them, and only one meets all the criteria for the site of the Tower of Babel, the site of Eridu in southeastern Mesopotamia. We see signs of expansion to the north, south, east, and west all the way to Egypt. DEL, when you say evidence, you mean the artifacts found in these archaeological digs? Doug, exactly. There's an enormous amount of very specific material culture that attests to this expansion of people, which I connect to the post-Babel dispersion. Here are the beveled rim bowls, this reemption brick, and those spouted jars. All these diagnostic forms of pottery and material culture are found throughout the Near East. The Bible describes not just the confusion of languages, but the dispersal of people far from that city. We see language, or the written expression of language, just popping up out of nowhere, with different languages represented through cuneiform script, hieroglyphic script, or other means. There isn't a universal pattern followed among all languages. You see great diversity in the forms of grammar from language to language, even in ancient languages. DL. So, it seems the event recorded in Genesis about the Tower of Babel is a critical event for archaeology. Doug. It is. All of this fits perfectly with the biblical account of how languages came about. It's the only way to explain it. The integrity of biblical history is ultimately justified by the expression of these languages. DL. Most of us today think of a tower as something like the skyscrapers we see in big cities with straight walls. Is that what they were building? Doug. It's essentially a variation of a pyramid, with four sides and several stairways leading to the top. At Eridu, there's a temple that existed in 18 different phases, and in each phase it grew in size and complexity. That final phase of the temple was abandoned immediately, right at the time of the late Uruk expansion. Catty corner to the temple was an absolutely enormous platform. DL. Do you think that could be the foundation of the Tower of Babel? Doug. Absolutely. I would suggest that this late Uruk expansion, where this technology began, spread with the people. We find forms of these ziggurats all around the globe. We find them in China, in India, in various parts of the Americas. All over. DL. Obviously, we have evidence here of civilization and people beginning to gather together in communities, even cities. Do we have any other evidence of that? Doug. Absolutely. We can move forward to the time of Abraham because we know that Abraham lived in Ur, also in southern Mesopotamia, at the end of the 3rd millennium BC. DL. That brings us to the end of Genesis chapter 11. Doug. Exactly. In fact, you can see pottery and cuneiform tablets that date to the period of the 3rd dynasty of Ur. DL. It's amazing, sitting here thinking about Abraham and that this represents the culture and civilization he lived in. It's a great tie to the record in Genesis. Doug. It is fascinating, and it gives you a feeling of putting your hands around the events that go on in the biblical text. DL. When I looked back through history, I realized each of these cultures had been impacted by the events recorded in Genesis. But what is the importance of Genesis to us today? DL. George Grant wanted to meet me at a garden near his home. He said it was a good reminder of where our history began. DL. There's something significant about the Genesis text where Adam and Eve are placed in a garden to tend it. That's more than just a story. George. It's much more than just a story. In Genesis chapter 1, you see the structure for time. The universe was created for a 24-hour day. Everything from our sleep cycles to our work cycles comes from that definitive historical account. In Genesis chapter 2, we start to see the meaning and purpose of man. Of course, in Genesis chapter 3, we see the disruption of everything by the fall. The implications of an historical fall, an actual man and an actual woman who actually yielded to actual sin, have implications throughout the rest of the Bible. If you remove a literal Adam and Eve, it changes the whole shape of what history is and how history is remembered. DL. Is that because when we pull Adam and Eve out of the historical record, we can then pretty much make up whatever we think about man, marriage, and even sexuality? George. Absolutely. The Apostle Paul understood the events of the early chapters of Genesis as formative, not only for our understanding of history, but for relationships between men and women and their children, the character and nature of marriage, right and wrong in moral relations, including sexuality. All that is assumed from those early chapters of Genesis, often quoting the passages verbatim. DL. It seems that even Peter is taking the event of the flood, for example, as a historical event and placing it in the context of a judgment that will come. So even judgment is part of understanding that historical record. George. You cut things off from history, and you lose sight of the meaning of all of it. DL. Most Christians understand the life of Christ, for example, as a historical account. Why is it that when we look at the account in Genesis, we have a tendency not to do that? George, we tend not to because we're constantly told not to. That's how it is. DL, does that come from the culture around us? George, from the culture around us, from theologians, modern theologians who are trying, somehow in their minds, to reconcile the truths of Scripture with the so-called discoveries of science, which, if you know anything about the history of science, you know is an incredibly unreliable path. So we're constantly bombarded with this message that we have to adjust our view. DL, but I think there are a lot of Christians who feel that the historicity of Genesis just isn't that important to their Christianity. George, I think we've been sold a bill of goods on that. When you somehow make those chapters a different category altogether and non-historical, what are you doing to all the rest of the Bible? The Bible that assumes that it's true, the Bible that treats it as historically true, the Bible that refers back to all of the characters that are there. Does that then negate the whole of the Bible? Well, yes, and that's exactly what the strategy was of the higher critics in the 18th and 19th centuries. They knew if you could somehow attack the first three or the first 11 chapters of Genesis, you've done away with the whole thing. DL, well, George, all of this brings us back then to the notion that the history that's recorded in Genesis, or any true history at all, is critical for us in terms of understanding what's going on around us. George, yeah. In fact, it reminds us of just how important history is in anchoring all of the other human disciplines. It is history that helps to inform science so that science can begin its journey of discovery in the world. So what history does is it tells us what happened. Then what science attempts to do is it asks the question, well, how did it happen? And then it begins to explore the how, the mechanics, the structures that were present in those events. If you try and reverse that, if you try and make science say what actually happened, then you wind up having a worldview that is constantly shifting, where nothing is certain and moral relativism is that necessary outcome. DL. And God has given us that bedrock. He has given us that foundation in that historical record. George, He's given it to us in that historical record going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, back to the garden. DL. In the end, I suppose we always return home. And for me, home is Colorado. I always think more clearly when I'm out in the beauty of God's creation. We've been a lot of places and seen a lot of things, but considering everything together, it's clear that nothing in the world makes sense except in the light of Genesis. DL. I love being in the mountains, especially ones like these. They help give us a good perspective, help us realize that we're small and finite and vulnerable. They humble us. And we need to be humbled because we have a tendency to base our ideas on our own small set of experiences. That's why the wisdom of the ages has told us over and over again to know history. Everything that we have done up to this point has looked at the evidence that shows us that the Word of God, the history that has been laid down for us in Genesis, is true. God created the world in 6 days. There was a real Adam, a real Eve. There was a real fall. There was a real flood that destroyed the world and produced all of this. It is glorious, but it represents the judgment of God. Everything supports what God has told us. Genesis is history, true history. That's just the way it is, plain and simple. DL. Does that perspective stem from the culture that surrounds us? George. Absolutely. It comes from the culture we live in, and even from certain theologians, modern theologians, mind you, who are bending over backward, trying to somehow reconcile the inerrant truths of Scripture with the so-called discoveries of science. But if you know even a little about the history of science, you quickly realize it's an incredibly shaky and unreliable foundation to build on. So, relentlessly, we're bombarded with this subtle message that we need to reevaluate, to adjust our understanding of things. DL. But I think you'll find a fair number of Christians who honestly believe that whether or not Genesis is a historically accurate account really isn't all that important to their Christian faith. George, I think we've been sold a false bill of goods on that one, to be honest. When you arbitrarily decide to relegate those early chapters to a completely different, non-historical category, what exactly are you doing to the rest of the Bible? I mean, think about it, the entire Bible assumes those accounts are true. It treats them as historically accurate events. It constantly refers back to the characters who populate those narratives. So, does that then invalidate the entire Bible? Well, yes, that's precisely what the strategy was for the higher critics back in the 18th and 19th centuries. They understood that if you could somehow undermine the credibility of just the first few chapters of Genesis, say, the first 3 or the first 11, you've effectively pulled the rug out from under the whole thing. DL, well, George, all of this discussion ultimately brings us back to the core concept. The history recorded in Genesis, or indeed any accurate historical account, is absolutely critical for us in terms of truly understanding the world around us and what's happening in it. George, absolutely. In fact, it serves as a potent reminder of just how vital history is for grounding and anchoring all other areas of human knowledge and inquiry. It's history that provides the crucial context that informs scientific investigation, allowing science to embark on its journey of discovery and exploration of the natural world. So, the fundamental role of history is to tell us what actually happened. Then, science steps in and attempts to answer the question, okay, how did it happen? And from there, science sets about exploring the mechanics, the processes, and the underlying structures that were at play during those events. Now, if you try to flip that order, if you try to make science dictate what actually happened in the first place, then you inevitably end up with a constantly fluctuating worldview, where nothing is fixed or certain and moral relativism becomes the unavoidable consequence. DL, and God, in his infinite wisdom, has given us that solid bedrock. He's provided us with that essential foundation in the form of the historical record. George, exactly. He's given it to us through that historical record, stretching all the way back to the very beginning, to Genesis chapter 1, back to the Garden of Eden. DL, in the end, I guess we always find ourselves drawn back to where we truly belong, back to our roots. And for me, that place is undoubtedly Colorado. I always find that my thoughts are clearer, more focused, when I'm surrounded by the breathtaking beauty of God's creation here. We've traveled to many places and witnessed countless things. But when you take everything into consideration, it becomes undeniably clear that nothing in this world ultimately makes sense unless it's viewed through the clarifying lens of Genesis. DL, I absolutely love being in the mountains, especially these majestic peaks. They really help to put things into perspective, reminding us that we are, in the grand scheme of things, small, limited, and vulnerable beings. They humble us. And a dose of humility is something we all need, because we're so prone to basing our judgments and opinions on our own narrow range of experiences. That's why the accumulated wisdom of generations has constantly emphasized the importance of knowing history. Everything we've explored up to this point points to the undeniable truth that the Word of God, the history that's been laid down for us in Genesis, is absolutely true and trustworthy. God truly created the world in 6 days. There was a real Adam, a real Eve, not just symbolic figures. There was a real fall with devastating consequences. And there was a real cataclysmic flood that destroyed the world as it was and sculpted the very landscape we see around us today. It's a glorious sight, certainly, but it's also a powerful reminder of the judgment of God. Ultimately, everything we observe supports what God has revealed to us. Genesis is history, genuine history.